Welcome to Series 2 of Distillery Sessions, Proud to Be. I'm Steve Ween, founder of Distillery, an international content studio and also board member of Outvertising, the LGBTQ+ advertising advocacy group run by industry volunteers on a mission to drive LGBTQ+ equality in the advertising and marketing industry. Now, Proud to Be is a short series of interviews as part of Diversity Month. I'll be talking to D&I leaders at organisations such as eBay and Innocent Drinks, heroing designers from across the globe, looking at great resources and sharing ideas and thoughts for wherever you are in your organisation's D&I journey. In today's first episode, I'm talking to Colette Phillip, who runs award-winning brand and strategy consultancy Brand By Me, helping organisations tackle inequality and drive social justice through brand strategy. She's worked with, on, and for a breadth of amazing brands for over 20 years, from household names to amazing charities. Colette is also a celebrated speaker and writer, and has been featured on BBC, Huffington Post, Forbes, and Third Sector magazine, talking about everything from business to branding to anti-racism. Thank you so much for joining us today, Colette. Can I start off by asking you why you decided to set up Brand By Me?
Thanks for having me, first of all. So I set up Brand By Me about 5 years ago. I've always worked in, on, for and around brands. I started life in advertising, and then I kind of did a bit of a career change and moved into the charity sector. So I worked at Barnardo's, the children's charity. And then from there sort of flipped back and forth between commercial sector and charities. So I worked for T-Mobile and EE, and then I worked for an animal charity. And I'd been at the animal charity for about just under 5 years, and I'd led a global rebrand and even led the organizational strategy process along with one other lead. And I got to the stage and I was just sort of like, kind of three things really. I was a bit like, okay, so what next in terms of brand role? Because I've done quite a lot now. I've done a couple of rebrands, big, small, new purpose for organizations. I've done that. I am ambitious, so I was looking to move into a leadership role, but that wasn't really happening. And then I took a career break and I set up Brand By Me. I literally woke up in the middle of the night and was like, I need to set up my own thing, and it's going to be called Brand By Me, and it's all about brands that drive social change. And then that's what I did. And 5 years on, we are still doing that. We're a little tighter on our proposition, but basically that's where we are, and that's the story. I was frustrated, not just within my career and where it was going, but also I think at the time, what was on offer in terms of brand strategy, particularly in the charity sector, particularly for growing ambitious charities, what was on offer, I felt there was a real gap, and I also felt that charities, in terms of just driving this sense of social change and social justice, I felt like charities could play a way bigger role than they were. And I think that came to a brand issue in terms of how people were defining their purpose and what that stood for. Mm-hmm. And that's where it came from, really. And as I said, we've been doing it ever since.
I love the fact that you just woke up in the middle of the night, you had the name ready to go, and you just went off and got it off the ground.
In brand strategy, that's kind of how it works, I think. As sad as that might sound, it's true.
I wanted to start off by asking you, if you think it's fair to say that there is a clear lack of inclusion, diversity, and fair representation within our industry?
Yeah, I think that's very fair. And I think it goes deeper than that, because I often, when we focus on representation, we're not sort of looking or at or addressing the underlying causes. So I think it's really important that we focus on equity and justice. And I think because of historical, structural sort of forms of oppression, our sector is way behind where it needs to be. And I think that causes the sector some problems. And I think that's absolutely fair to say that we're way behind on this.
Do you think there are any organisations that are actually doing this well that you could call out and perhaps that we could take a lead from or learn from?
Okay, no, but I do think we can all learn from each other because of that. Because I think, and I was having this conversation with this amazing anti-racism consultant and trainer, Martha Awajobi, and we were having this conversation. I think it comes back to organizations and brands being really, really humble about, which is brands aren't used to being like that, but being really humble about where you are and accepting that because this is systemic and structural and embedded in the very fabric of society, nobody is nailing it, and that's okay. What we need to do is, no one's nailing it overall, but there is lots and lots of great efforts and good practice and things that are starting to embed. And if we all as a sector try and uplift and share that sort of learning, what it means is that learning doesn't sit just with one organization or even a group of passionate people who then, when they move on to a different organization or move on to something else, that's all lost. But it starts to embed a sort of sector level understanding of change and a sector level repository of learning from, you know, the pockets of good practice that are happening. And I don't mean that disparagingly, because when I say pockets of good practice, I think, you know, there are brands across sectors. Like I can look at what Ben and Jerry's are doing, and I think some of what they're doing at the moment, particularly around racial justice and the way they talk about it, is awesome. I love the way that the RNLI respond as a brand in crisis. I love the way that Shelter have started, Shelter led by the CEO, sort of talk about equity and justice throughout their work and are willing to comment on stuff outside of their core remit around housing and homelessness. So that, and I would say all of those things, there's three examples, pockets of good practice. Does it mean that those brands are doing everything right? No. Does it mean that those brands don't have problems that they ongoing need to fix? Does it mean that those brands are kind of leading the way in terms of equity and justice or you know, consistently sort of have done the work? Absolutely not. They're still in the process of it. But from those kind of pockets of great practice where they are, there's something that we can all learn and be inspired by and embed into our own brands.
I think that's a really good point. The shared learning piece from those pockets of great practice you mentioned. I mentioned in my intro that I sit on the board of Outvertising, and one of the things that we talk a lot about is positive action, moving forward, not being afraid to get it wrong, because no organization is doing this perfectly. No one has all of the answers, but as long as we're moving forward and sharing learnings.
Yeah, I think there's a third bit to add to that. And I think there's a third bit and a really important, I guess, caveat stroke criteria, which is, and you'll get this from Outvertising because it's in the very nature of the way the organization's set up. I feel the same. We get the same from Media for All. You have to be led by people with lived experience of the oppressions you're seeking to tackle. And that's the bit, because I would go, if you get it a little bit wrong, if you're led by people with lived experiences of the oppressions you want to tackle and, you know, kind of lived experiences that are probably of a number of different oppressions, right? So whether you're talking, yeah, I am a Black woman, so there's an intersection there, you know, or you're talking about people of colour within the LGBTQIA communities, that is where you need to, or, you know, disabled people of colour, this is where you need to be. Because if you are led by people with those lived experiences and the complexity of a few of those, it means that you will be able to understand how to avoid doing harm to the very, you know, how to avoid doing harm. Because don't get me wrong, I think there's part of me that says, a big part actually for brands that goes, fear of doing it, getting it wrong and therefore doing nothing is way worse than doing something. The caveat is, unless you are haven't engaged people with lived experiences of those oppressions and therefore you end up doing harm. Because that place, I think it's better that you do nothing than do harm. But actually, do the doing harm bit is easily avoided. It's just, I guess it's the arrogance of, this is so this deep stuff, the arrogance of patriarchy and white supremacy and that sort of embedded structural stuff that stops people from valuing reaching out to the communities that actually they just need to be led by. But that's a very, that's at one end of the spectrum and the worst end, which leads you to, you know, that Pepsi Kendall Jenner of a number of years ago, that's where that leads you. On the other hand, I think I think that at a societal level, well, certainly at a charity level, there's an understanding of the power of lived experience and the value of it and the fact that actually that sort of involvement and leadership and community sense of community and interdependence is really important. So that's what I would say. I wholeheartedly agree. Don't just sit there, be scared and do nothing. Definitely do something, but do it in a way that's led by people with lived experiences.
Yes. Yeah. I couldn't agree more. And just sort of weaving back to my experience with advertising, from my perspective, you know, really when we're talking about making work more inclusive, including the community, you know, you've got to include that community in the process. You've got to have people from the community engaged in the project in different ways. But you've got to open up those discussions and really get that feedback loop going.
I was just on that. I think when we talk about sometimes, I you know, it's funny, like using the word kind of engage people, I'm like, I've even sometimes like I go, I've said be led by specifically because I think engage with, you could say, well, yeah, I went out to them once with, and we actually have I've spoken about this in, there's, I'm doing some work with the Wellcome Trust, along with, we're, Brand By Me are partnering with another organisation called Disability, because we're tackling both anti-racism and anti-ableism. And this is one of the things that we heard where people say engage, they tend to, and this happened actually, I think it happens in both communities of colour, but also in the disabled community, where people will say, we've engaged. They go and talk to people once, they may listen, probably don't take on half of what people have said, and then just go off and do it. And then they come back to da at the end. That's not engagement. So I feel like when I say being led by, obviously it goes back to leadership, but I said, I think there's a sense of listening and then being led by what those people then tell you, even if it's expensive, even if it's not at all what you thought it was going to be, even if they're telling you, you know, bin this and start again, that's the difference. I guess that's a humility in being led by people with lived experiences, as opposed to just engaging with them, which means we can go and talk to you once, listen to what you want to say, and then doesn't matter if we don't, we doesn't matter if we talk to you again or not, and we might not listen. Which, and I'd say, obviously, you know this, Steve, right? That's not, the definition of engagement is definitely not what I just described. But when we say engage, that's what people often mean. So that's where we talk about being led by lived experiences, because it sort of stops you doing that sort of tick boxy stuff.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. For Distillery, as an international content studio, we're always looking at building the right teams for different projects and how the right people can go on a journey with the project. And if you're on a journey, you might not end up in the place that you're expecting to end up, and how to not be scared of that.
Yeah, I'd agree with that 100%. I love that sense of, is that not being scared? Like, rather than setting out on a prescriptive sort of, this is the end, it kind of is, it's a journey versus destination. So rather than having a prescriptive destination in mind and then going and finding people that either will endorse that, or worse, just speaking to people and asking leading questions or leading them away so they only endorse what your destination is. It is about that sense of journey and adventure, of not knowing maybe where you're going to get to, where you're setting off, but having the right people and being led, you know, you being, I guess, rather than you being the guide, sort of shepherding the journey, it's like you being one of the people that is being led and guided on that journey. And I love that. I love that.
Yeah, I'd love for you to talk to us a little bit about that story identification process. We had a wonderful discussion about this as we were prepping for this podcast episode. At Distillery, we're always looking at different stories for brands to tell as part of their marketing toolkit. And the first piece of that storytelling funnel, thinking about how to identify stories that are more inclusive, that both meets the criteria for what the brand is, it's trying to achieve by telling a certain story, but also really achieving that more inclusive lens.
Yeah, so this is one I have a very strong view on, but my view, I think that a part of that is accepting that there is going to be conflict in this, and it comes down to the equity piece here. So when we talk about inclusive storytelling, people think, okay, we have this, they decide on the story they want to tell, and then they go out and find representation across that story to tell it, to find a way of telling it. The issue with that is that, you know, the question we always ask is, who's telling this story and why? And rather than seeing, I guess, people from minoritized backgrounds as passive participants in a story you want to tell, actually the starting place is probably, as we talked about before, let's listen to those people from minoritized communities or with lived experiences of oppression. Let's listen to them. What stories do they want to tell, and what's our role within it? And I think I think that's a powerful place to get to. The thing I think where it causes conflict for organizations is that, at the moment we know this, if you're looking at media quite specifically and trying to find ways of fitting into a specific agenda or something like that, it sort of works against your inclusive storytelling. It can do. It doesn't always, but it can do. So for the simple reason is that there, some of the ways, some of the kind of who's telling the story and why are often built on inherently colonial or inequitable or kind of patriarchal or white supremacist narratives, even if people don't know it. People won't advertise that way. People don't say, oh, no, that's what we're trying to do. It's completely sort of below the surface, but that bias is there. So it means that by default, it's the difference between, you know, so I remember one of my clients was doing this, doing a really great project about looking at the power of Black women in business. And we're going to do something to kind of really harness the power of Black women in business and really sort of remove some of these structural barriers. They got some media coverage, some of it brilliant, some of it not. And that was down to who was telling the story and why. So through that media, through the stories that were being, the same project, very different stories were told. One was about, you know, amazing, about changing the narrative of what entrepreneurship looks like, which is exactly what this was designed to do. Another one was, you know, this is why I think it was, you know, another lens was like, Black women in business are struggling right now. Well done to said organization or brand for helping them. Two very different narratives. Two would, on the surface, could be considered inclusive because they are championing an underrepresented or minoritized group. But actually, from an equity point of view, only one of those stories is truly equitable and sort of driving forward that community, if that makes sense.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. Can you give us an example of an action that could have been taken to stop that situation? What could have been done to highlight or address that?
Yes, I can talk to it, because I think there is a fundamental difference, I guess, between the two media owners stroke platforms that were telling those different stories that I described. One of them had, you know, had an understanding of kind of power, privilege, and equity and bias and how that shows up. So they'd done some work and they'd done some training around it. So they were really aware of their role and responsibility and maybe the power imbalance in the stories they were telling. So they were quite keen. They knew that that was something going in. They had to address that. So they worked, they were willing, as you said, that first part of the process in terms of really listening to people with lived experiences. But also it was about who was doing the listening, and who was telling that story. And the person doing the listening on one of the kind of, I guess, the positive example I talked about, where I said it was a really equitable, kind of brilliant story that moved forward the community. The person telling, reporting on that story, the person doing the listening was from the very same community, right? So so in this case, I talked about was power of business in Black women. The person equally, the journalist covering the story was a Black woman who had an understanding, who sought to understand, who had a, the journalists themselves were given a remit to go out there and sort of create the story, not create this line and find things to evidence it, but create the story, you know, find out what the story is here by listening to these Black women and then create the narrative in kind of collaboration with the women you're speaking to. So that's, I guess there's a number of things there. It's one, making sure that people have a real understanding about equity and power and privilege and how it shows up in comms. It's making sure that you have professionals and experts from the same communities that you're looking to kind of engage and raise the profile of. It's making sure, I guess the other thing is making sure there is a feedback loop. So listening is, you know, you listen at the beginning, but you also constantly, we talked about this, constantly check in with that community, constantly check back it throughout your process development. So rather than not just, oh, we've listened to you, here's the final copy, or even not here's the final copy, here you see it in, you know, the press or wherever it is, you see the story and it's told. And I think there are a few of the things that you can do, trying to think of any others. Seeing it as seeing these storytelling as kind of a partnership and a shared kind of responsibility and a joy, and then understanding kind of what are some of the barriers that you're going to come up against in terms of telling that, you know, allowing that story to be told in a way that is really going to highlight and uplift that community. And recognizing as part of it that your brand, and this is weird for a brand agency to say, your brand might be secondary to that, and that's okay. Because one of the things we learn as brands is that actually the strength of your brand can ultimately be built by you being a platform to allow these stories to be brought to life, rather than you having to be the one leading, driving and telling the story the whole time.
I love the fact you're coming at this from our perspective. You know, as a business, we're working with brands who've so often already got their story written, if you know what I mean. They've already got their focus. They've got their core pillars. They've got frameworks for their brand. Everything seems set in stone. But actually, I think the piece around purpose, and if a brand is truly creating genuine purpose and value, to create engagement and to create that audience organically, they've got to be open to a shift. It's got to be part of the listening piece.
Yeah, I might build on it too, actually, and go with this. So what we find is, I think, so there's a couple of, it depends on the strength of your brand framework and when it was done and how it was done. So there'll be kind of maybe three things that will happen when you come up against this stuff. And the brand will both, as you've highlighted, help or hinder. You can, if your purpose is strong and enduring and has equity and justice within it, even implicitly, then you can use your purpose as the filter and reason why and thing you're trying to evidence and the reason why you do this stuff. So rather than, you know, inclusion, equity, diversity sitting as a silo somewhere in HR, actually it's, you know, you go, this is core to who we are because our purpose or our values say this. And that's where it was a strength. So as a brand consultancy, where we've built brands since the start of Brand By Me have always had the equity piece in them somewhere in the values. They've always had something that allows you to make sure that you are being equitable in every approach. That's the first option. That's the first sort of way this could go, right? And that's cool, because you go, actually, we can use our purpose. When people are asking us, why are we bothering with this diverse thing? Or why are we talking about this when, you know, it's not, why are we talking about trans people? That's nothing to do with our work with, I don't know, homelessness or whatever. You know, that's, I pulled that example totally off the top of my head, by the way, that is not real. But, you know, if people are saying that, you can say, because this is our purpose, and that's why, you know, so we, you know, whether it's saying, a really great example of this, actually, the RNLI, their vision is to save everyone, everyone being two words, to save everyone, which means that when people ask them things like, why are you rescuing refugees? You shouldn't be. Or why are you working overseas? They're like, because our purpose and our vision to save everyone. They can draw back everything they do to that, and it just acts as the answer. It's absolutely the answer and the reason for being. So that's a written example of how purpose in this sense can really help that. It can ground your D&I and your EDI efforts. The second thing that may happen is that you may find that actually your purpose was developed in a way that, and this happens where people have done their brand years and years ago, where before people understood what purpose is and why it's so important. So mission, where particularly charities, but some, you know, companies too, have missions, and missions will be a description of what you do rather than why you do it. And if that's the case, your mission might not be clear on why you need to be equitable and, you know, tackle justice and be, you know, prioritize inclusion as part of your approach, because actually fundamentally your mission is so specific, actually it's really not fit for purpose anymore. And that's why what you said is true. You need to revisit, you need to review, you need to evolve it. The third, and I guess this is where I build, because I went, you said evolve it with your audience. Sometimes organizations are going to find that you're going to have to evolve your brand beyond your audience. And this is something that's happened at the moment. And it's quite a tricksy little conversation, but I'll have it anyway. And I say this, you know, I say this as boldly, as bluntly as I can, because I take it in the work that I do now that this is read, that actually our structures, fundamentally, oppressions are built into some of the structures and the way that kind of society and things are just built. So audiences in line, depending on if your audience, you may have elements of your audience that don't agree with or buy into the equity work that you're doing. You still need to evolve and do that equity work. If your purpose, and it should be the purpose of every single, it should be the purpose of every organization to make the world better. It should be the purpose of every organization. But specifically, if we're talking charity sector, we should be really looking at how we, you know, are making the world a better place and, you know, making society better. That's our role as charities. Even if we take on specific bits of the mission within it, overall, we should be trying to achieve that through our specific lens. Which means that fundamentally, if you found out through your work that you are kind of fueling an oppression, or you're doing stuff in a very biased and patriarchal or racist, systemically racist way, or you're benefiting from oppression in your work, you're going to need to evolve it. There may be elements of your audience that just aren't there yet, because they've not been on that learning, they're not on that journey, they don't understand it. You're still going to have to move. So I guess back to your point in terms of you need to evolve your purpose in line with your audience. Sometimes you need to evolve your purpose in line with what the world needs, and it moves you beyond your audience. And then you can bring, and frequently we see this, and we see it. God, if you look at the RNLI's Twitter feed, whenever they put out something about their work, you see that education job happening there and then. They bring their audience with them, many of their audience with them. But some people, if they're entrenched, if fundamentally they're there, you might have to leave them behind. And there has to be a recognition that that's okay. And hopefully your organization will find that you've not got audience of people who fundamentally just do not understand depression and not, you know, are not willing to engage with it at all. Hopefully that's not all your audience, but regardless, you are going to have to move and evolve.
Yeah, you know, I love it when you get a brand response on social that is just so bang on. Like, you know, for example, when they've posted about Pride and they get some hate and they make it clear that they're happy to lose homophobic customers.
It's interesting. So when you see these brands' responses, whenever you ask the question to these brands, well, how do you know what to do? The answer is always clarity of purpose and because it's our values. Every single time. It's never because our social media team are really cool and you know, they're at the forefront. It's never, that's not the answer. It always comes back, a meaningful brand response always comes back to, because this is our purpose and these are our values. And that's why they can speak with such strength and conviction, where they're like, sorry, not you, you know, people that seem to have a real issue with the existence of trans people. Sorry, not you. We don't want you as part of our brand. Thank you. Do not buy our product anymore. And they can be that strong with it. They can be that strong with it because they're like, sorry, this is what our brand is for, not you. And if you don't like it, you can go and buy somewhere else. And we love to see brands standing up in that way. It reinforces for many consumers, for the majority. You see this like with everything from tea to, you know, from all sorts of things. You see it, and it really encourages and uplifts people. I tell you who's an example of this. Nationwide Bank seem to nail it. And often people are like, well, we're going to close my account. And they're like, yes, here's the way to do it. Here's the link to close it. And it's like, and people love it. And they always, I heard this anecdotally, but whenever there's a sort of a big storm like that, or a bit of storm of outrage, they always seem to pick up new accounts because people are like, we love Nationwide. I need to switch my bank now because my bank's saying nothing on this.
Yeah. It's that point of view piece.
I do think it comes back to that. Who's telling this story and why? And then I guess there's a few clues in there when we look at kind of the storytelling. It's first of all, who's telling this story and why? And then who benefits? And actually, those three questions, when we ask them, often when we look at this, it does help maybe throw up kind of biases. So we're working with one client and they were like, who's telling this story and why? And we're like, oh, all our experts are always white and male and non-disabled. That doesn't, and we didn't, and so who benefits from this? And then you sort of start to delve into kind of where the bias sits and why that's happening, or, you know, and you ask yourself, okay, so who's telling the story and why? And that why thing, it's like, why is that person telling the story? That makes no sense. It needs to be this person. So I think that's a really good one to sort of uncover and start to interrogate storytelling. In terms of unconscious bias, I mean, it's difficult for me because honestly, I think unconscious bias, the framing of unconscious bias is often really helpful because it places the holder of bias as completely helpless and with no responsibility. Whereas nowadays I go, actually, the minute your unconscious bias is often immediately rendered conscious by your actions, behavior, points of view, your response when challenged. And the minute it's made conscious means you can do something about it. So when we are still resting on unconscious biases and making them conscious, I'm not sure how helpful that is. So I think there's something around challenging our assumptions around stories. And also, I think trying to make it a priority to tell those, go out there and really look through our storytelling to surface and confront biases, I think it stops you from playing into them. So if you're very clear about the narrative and the agenda that you want to disrupt, for example, for advertising, it would be actively aiming to tell stories from LGBTQIA community members, leaders, voices, and sharing those. It will stop you playing into the biases of, so for example, what family looks like or who gets to be leaders.
I think the confronting biases piece is really interesting when we're creating content for brands, especially when, you know, we're always interrogating the casting process, for example.
Exactly that. But that's what I was saying. If you actively, so I guess there's two things there, actually. I think there's a few things, not even two, but I can think of at least two. The first one is, if you need to understand, I guess we need to be aiming to dismantle and disrupt what the typical, what the oppressive narratives are. So for example, and we need to be understanding, this is where the listening comes in, because you'll hear that when you, if you listen to people with lived experiences, you'll hear about the assumptions and the prejudice and the just the nonsense they face. So for example, when I said to you before, I did this project around Black women in business with one of my clients, and I'm a Black founder and I count myself in this. We did a listening exercise, which I facilitated. We facilitated it Brand By Me. And every single founder, as part of that working group, had experienced issues in finding finance. Every single founder. Then, at the same time, it just so happened that the British Business Bank was doing a bit of research. They found exactly the same thing. So actually, then you go, okay, so then in our advertising, let's look at this. If we're only ever showing, if we've got, you know, the kind of business banking, whatever, and we're only ever showing white males, we're absolutely fueling this narrative. So we need to actively go out and look for the, understand and seek out the assumptions and the narratives that we need to dismantle, destabilize, disrupt, and if we're actively trying to do that, you immediately stop yourself from playing into biases, as opposed to what we said in terms of handpicking people who fit our chosen narrative of what good looks like, what success looks like, who deserves support. And it's really important that we do that. But you kind of have to actively go out and try, have that as your objective. You know, you have to kind of say to yourself, we are just not going to tell this story because we need to say it differently.
Yeah, it's an active decision, right? You know, right from the get-go.
And this is where, I mean, from anti-racism work, but any sort of anti-oppression work, that's why comms has a role to, and we work on building specifically anti-racism, and then, you know, we partner with other partners and agencies to look at different forms of oppression. But fundamentally, this is why comms and brand has a role to play in anti-oppression work. It's everything we've just said, because actually, who owns the stories? Who's telling the stories? Who's creating the environment that furthers and deepens this oppression? Often that is within the remit of comms. So actually, if we, you know, it's not solely, I'm not saying you can comms your way out of structural racism or, you know, structural ableism or anything like that. You can't. You can't just comms your way out of it, but certainly comms has a role to play if you've made that, as you just talked about, very active decision to say, we are going to tackle this oppression, we are going to be anti-racist, we're going to be, we are going to come out firmly, for equity, diversity and inclusion.
Colette, we have discussed so much good stuff this morning. You've got so much to share. You were talking to me earlier about the hot seat. Could you talk us through it?
Yeah. So the hot seat is a series of masterclasses. And I think starting off with it, I was very clear that I wanted this to be a series of masterclasses, not just a one-off event. It's all about bringing brands into the hot seat. The hot seat being a seat on Zoom where I will ask them questions about what they're doing right now to embed anti-racism specifically, and also sometimes wider equity and inclusion into the heart of their brand and comms. So I'll ask them what they're doing, what they've learned, what's been challenging, and a really open, honest space, because it comes back to that conversation we had earlier about we need as sectors, as collective, we need to improve the collective learning. So this is why we're doing it. So that will be the big part of it. Every single masterclass starts with a call to action from an anti-racism expert. So a call to action about, you know, what the sector, what we as comms people, what we as marketeers need to do differently. And then it wraps up with an action planning exercise to embed what we've heard and learned during the session. So on the 19th, we've got a 19th of November is the next one, but they are a series and they're available on demand. And there's four of them. But the 19th of November, we've got an amazing disability justice and accessibility consultant called Suleiman Khan from a agency called Disability. He will be issuing his call to action to the sector. And then in the hot seat, we've got NCVO, the National Council for Voluntary Organizations. And I think that hot seat will be fascinating because you may or may not have heard of the hashtag not just NCVO, which came from a report that was leaked to the press, but the NCVO had commissioned to look into kind of the state of equity, diversity and inclusion in their organization. And they'd found, you know, lots of oppression. They found racism, they found bullying, they found loads of evidence of it. And that report actually kickstarted their action. And about a year into taking that action, then somebody leaked the report to the press. But actually, I found it really interesting in that brand, and this is what I'm really keen to delve into, is that the hashtag wasn't NCVO are terrible. It was not just NCVO, because people were like, this is a sector, a charity sector issue. So I've got the interim CEO of NCVO coming on the 19th of November. But as I said, these are a series. So we'll hear from brands like Bond, the Network for International Development. We're going to hear from Wellcome Trust as well. We've got amazing experts that are going to join us to talk about all aspects of embedding anti-racism into your brand, from how to lead it, to what to do if you get found out, called out, to how to bring together your teams to drive change. That's what this series of masterclasses is all about. So I think it's going to be fire, and I hope many of you will join us.
And how can people sign up?
Yeah, there's a link on the homepage under latest work that takes you right to the Eventbrite link to look. Or if you look for us at Brand by Me HQ on social media, you will see links and us talking about the event as well.
So we'll also include a link in the description. And before I let you go, I wanted to ask you one last question that we're also asking all of our guests in series two of Distillery Sessions. What does diversity mean to you?
My friend and fellow consultant, Suleiman, who I mentioned before, we have a really big take on this. We say diversity is a given, right? Diversity is about celebrating the breadth and wealth of different individual and collective lived experiences that exist, and it should be a given. It should be a given, because actually diversity is sort of a fact, right? We have a very big world with lots of different individuals within it. So diversity is just like a fact. But I guess where people come into it, where the conversation needs to happen is around a celebration of that, but also creating the equitable and inclusive solutions that allow that diversity to results in joy and wealth and brilliance of experience, rather than inequality and oppression, which sometimes it leads to.
Amazing. Colette, thank you so much for joining us today. It was really fascinating talking to you as part of our Proud to Be series here on Distillery Sessions. We've got a jam-packed series coming up. This is the first of a series of episodes. In our next episode, we'll be featuring Alana Flowers, an amazing designer. So stay tuned, and please give us a comment and a rating, and we'll see you next time.